Hello, Steve. Hello, Jill. It's time to game classy.
Progress. Recording in progress. The recording's in progress. The system is down. The system is down.
I was just... I was just showing my kids old Homestar Runner cartoons. They didn't quite get it, but...
Yeah, I think, like most comedies, it's a product of its time.
Yeah, I was laughing pretty hard because I was trying to find... I showed him Trogdor, of course. My son liked it. That's because someone's screaming the entire time, and... I was just trying to find the one episode of Strong Bad's emails where he says Aurora, Illinois. Aurora, Illinois. I don't know why, but that's one of the things. It's Homestar Runner is one of those weird things where there's like a 3-year period where people get the jokes, but anything outside of that 3-year period, it's like from when you're 42 years old to like 39. You get Homestar Runner, and if you're any older or any younger, you don't.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. All right, Steve. Well, before I get anything, welcome to Game Classy. I'm your host Joe, and with me, as always, is my co-host Steve.
Game Classy.
Wider than a mile. So we got a couple things we want to talk about, and I don't think any of it's Games Workshop related. A change.
What a weird and wild situation.
Oh, and we do have questions on the Discord, which I need to make sure I don't forget to talk about.
Yes.
But first off, I don't know if it's like the biggest news in the world, because we kind of predicted it, but Games Workshop, but Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast have freaked the fuck out and are now calling it no. It's just going to be 5th edition. It's just a revision of 5th edition. I don't know. Did you see that news?
I did not, actually, no.
Yeah, they kind of... They freaked out, and there was like a whole thing where they talked to some of their designers and said, okay, it's not a new edition. It's not even 5.5. This is just the next version of 5th edition, which, in my opinion... It's 5.5, but whatever. That's just getting into semantics,
right?
Yeah. So they completely...
So they're not calling it 1D&D anymore.
No. It's not going to be. Well, that's I believe that was going to be the case. It wasn't going to be like. I don't believe that if they did 6th edition, they would call it 1D&D. I always think that like whenever they do an edition change, they usually have like a playtest title. Because wasn't 5th edition playtested as D&D Next?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so 5th ed was D&D Next, and 6th ed they were calling 1D&D, with probably the idea that they wouldn't actually call it 1D&D at release. Just like they don't have D&D Next anymore. There was a whole thing, a bunch of like designers and people reported on it, basically just saying that it's not going to be a 6th edition or even a 5.5. It's going to be just 5th edition.
Oh, I see here. Yeah, it's 1D&D are revisions to the existing 5th edition rules while keeping the bulk of those rules intact.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're basically not – so they're committed to not doing new editions, well, in name. They're going to do soft editions. That's all this is.
Yeah, it's probably going to be a new edition every two – a new soft reboot of the Player's Handbook. Every 3 years, I'm gonna guess. Yeah, so every 3 years, they'll redo the Player's Handbook and the DM Guide with some slightly tweaked rules.
Yeah, and then not, you know, and just be like, no, it's still the same edition.
It's still the same edition. So yeah. It's like what Games Workshop does between like every 2 or 3 editions. They just basically keep the same edition, tweak the rules, call it a new edition, and then like every 3 years, they completely revamp the rule set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there you go on that.
No, that makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. That does kind of fit with how the design of the game was going anyway, simply because like with Tasha's Cauldron, like that book, like essentially that book is like a 0.5 in itself. Like that book has enough like rules variants and changes that are arguably playing D&D 5 and D&D 5 plus Tasha's Cauldron is like different enough to be two different editions of the game.
Yeah. And it's I think a lot of this is Wizards, just whoever is the on the upper level, just not being able to handle it. In the, they're too afraid of their bottom line. They're too afraid of their profit margins.
Oh,
to,
yeah.
To screw it up and call it sixth edition or.
Well, I mean, you know what's happened.
What's that?
Something that I never thought could have ever happened ever.
What's that?
D&D is too big to fail.
D&D is too big to fail. D&D's always kind of been too big to fail. It's like.
The difference between D&D's size now and time previously is. Exponential.
I agree. I just know that D&D, it's just the name. Like, you can get away with anything as long as you have the Dungeons and Dragons name. It's like Crayola or Xerox. It's everything's a Dungeons and Dragons. Like, you're playing Call of Cthulhu? No, you're just playing Dungeons and Dragons, but it's the 1920s.
Yes, that statement is undeniably true. Like, I'm not going to disagree. It's like you could do whatever you want and the game will just keep going. Because it's just so big at this point. Like, there's no way it's not. However, if you do anything to make the line go down, you have a whole ton of stockholders who are, you know, going to come for your balls. So that's why.
I always wondered that, like, if they could hypothetically do a line go down, like a real sharp line go down, almost like, let's say, fourth edition for, and I'm just saying in terms of sales, like you tank it for an edition, you let it run for 3 years, you take that hit, but because your profits go down so low that when you relaunch the new edition that's better, hopefully, you know, if you do everything correctly, the line will go up and it makes it look like you're that much more of a genius because the line had gone up as far as it could go. So the only way to go is go down and then reset the line to go up.
Your first mistake there was assuming that any capitalist thinks that there's a limit to how far a line go up.
You are correct.
That was your first mistake.
I've made many mistakes, and that's why I myself am a communist. I don't know if we I like the idea of the Soviet national anthem, but I think Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land" is a more appropriate for me type of song. It's not as hard hitting.
It's also a super communist anthem, but they usually edit out the lines that make it a hard hitting communist album.
Yeah, exactly.
There's that. It's a little soft for me.
Yes. You know me, promoting communism while also promoting silly tabletop games.
I like the oomph of the Soviet anthem. It's got a lot of chutzpah.
You're not my co-host, Steve. You're our co-host.
I'm our co-host.
But yes, so the Dungeons and Dragons in and of itself is probably not going to have any major changes from 5th to whatever they're going to call this. It's just going to be Dungeons and Dragons. I don't even think... I think Wizards of the Coast is finally figuring out that in gaming, addition change equals death.
I mean, it's like, it all depends on how you do it. Like, there's been a few games where, like, I don't know, I guess I would say, like, I'll pick the one. Like, there is one that has done it flawlessly. And it's as far as I know, I mean, please, if anyone knows any other game that's done it as well as this, please let me know, because I'm pretty sure this is the only one that's done it. But Call of Cthulhu by Chaosium. Okay. They are the gods of new editions.
Yep.
Because every new edition of Call of Cthulhu is considered a new edition. It's like, this is now 7th edition, but they've never invalidated any books.
Yeah. Unless, like, they have a new version of the book come out.
Right. And even then, you can still use the old version.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't actually replace it. Like, if you have, you know, if you have Terror on the Orient Express, like, if you have that from 3rd edition, you can play that with the new 8th edition core book, or you can buy the 8th edition version of Terror on the Orient Express. It's like, it's whatever you want. And it's the only game that I know of where, like, you don't have people dumping their books when a new edition comes out, because they're just like, why would I dump these books? I can still use them. Like,
yep, you're absolutely right. The only thing that I would have to say against that is that Chaosium, I don't know, has ever turned a profit.
I mean, they had to have done it at least in Japan, because Call of Cthulhu is the number one RPG in Japan, so there's got to be something there.
Yeah, no, I kid, but they don't. They're not a very big profit company. They're just a small gaming company. I mean, in terms of companies, they are tiny. I think probably the cabinet maker down the block from me probably has a larger company than Chaosium.
It doesn't mean the idea is wrong, though.
No.
And you could easily transplant it and just macro scale it. And I think that, and judging by what I've just read and what you just told me about this D&D 5th, it just seems like that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
They're just going to copy the Chaosium Call of Cthulhu style. And I mean, that makes sense. Like, it's a fine thing, especially for an RPG. That's the other thing, too. Like, when you do edition changes for games that have any sort of competitive design, like, you have to invalidate the old stuff. And I know people like hate it, and they're like, oh, I'm gonna sell all my old books, I gotta buy the new books. Like, I understand that, like, that's like a there's like a drain there. I get it. Like, trust me, I mean, we've been playing Warhammer for a long time. We get the deal. But the problem is, if you don't do that and your game is competitive, it just becomes a fucking nightmare. It becomes like, oh well, I'm playing 40K, but this dude's using his book from like 16 years ago because it has some busted interaction that someone didn't foresee with the new 10th edition of the rules. But because we don't make books invalid, the game just goes in the toilet. And that's, or it becomes so prohibitively expensive to play, you get the LCG syndrome with Fantasy Flight, where it's just like, oh yeah, I'd love to play Game of Thrones. That's cool. Well, how do I get it started? Well, you buy this starter and then $800 worth of supplements.
I 100% agree with everything you're saying on that one. But I'm thinking even deeper, is that Wizards of the Coast realized that if we call it an edition change, people get upset. So let's just get away from the idea of editions altogether.
Right, exactly.
So unlike Chaosium, which is like, this is now 8th edition, 7th edition's all still good. Everything's all still good all the way back. It would be as if Chaosium said, here's the new Call of Cthulhu. And people were like, oh, is this a new edition? No. Well, the rules have changed. Yes, it's just Call of Cthulhu. It doesn't say anything on the book about what edition it is. It's like, there's no edition anymore. It's just Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah. No, so that makes sense. So just making it Dungeons and Dragons, like, it makes sense. Like, I mean,
it kind of does from... and you can still change the rules. You can still put out new players books. You just don't call it a new edition.
Like, to give it a perspective to the listeners, because they might not all understand this or remember it or know it or even pay attention to D&D, but like, D&D books used to go out of print, like in previous editions. Like, they would stop printing D&D books. So like in 3rd, 3.5 and 4th, like, they would release, I don't know, Gods of the Realm. And like, that book would only be in print for a couple years, and then it would stop. They would stop printing on it and continue printing other new books while keeping the core books in print. The core books were the only books that never went out of print. That was like the rule for Dungeons and Dragons. Like, you would always have your player's handbook, your monster manual, your Dungeon Master's Guide. All of the other books were rotational. So like I said, Realm of the Gods comes out, and then like, that book is gone and no longer able to be bought after, a couple of years, because they stopped printing it. They don't make it anymore. And then that's how the dev cycle worked. They would make new books, print them for a while, they'd stop printing them, then make new books. Not a single Dungeons and Dragons 5th edition product is unavailable. They're still in print. The only difference is the first two adventures that were two books, Horde of the Dragon Queen and Rise of Tiamat. Horde of the Dragon Queen and Rise of Tiamat are finally out of print, but that's only because they released them as a combined book called Tyranny of Dragons.
Yep, and that's absolutely correct. They are really good about keeping all of that in print,
which is not normal for D&D. Like, that's never been the case. So this is this edition is its own thing. It's like its own animal.
Yeah. When did D&D 5th drop? I remember us talking about it on the podcast.
I think it was like 8 years ago, to be honest with you.
Let me see. D&D editions. I'm going to do the classic game classy. Let's just pull up it up on Wikipedia.
July 3rd, 2014 was the... Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay, the playtest packet was September 2013. The PDF containing complete rules. So the first complete rules were released. So this is not the books, but this is the first complete rules were available July 3rd, 2014.
So 2014, that puts us at going on 9 years at this point, right?
Yeah.
So, and I want to put this in perspective, though, is that AD&D 2nd ran from 89 to 95, right? So that's, what, 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry. It ran from 89 to 2000.
Oh, so that's a lot longer.
Yeah. So that's 10, 11 years at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 11 years for AD&D 2nd. I have about close to 40% of all published material made for Dungeons and Dragons 2nd edition, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's 40%. So I have two very nice large shelves in my office. My AD&D 2nd collection, of which I have 40% of the total collection.
So less than half, mind you.
Yes, less than half is six full shelves of that. That's more than one whole cabinet to just 2nd edition. I'm talking, these are, yes, I have the box sets on there as well. So they take up a little bit more space. But out of those, four of those shelves are just published material, like adventures, you know, resource guides, dungeon master guides, player stuff. But that's four shelves. My D&D 5th shelf is one shelf, and I have everything except two books published for 5th ed, and it's just one shelf.
Yeah, that the release schedule is just way, way smaller too.
It's way smaller. They're keeping everything in print. They do a really nice job. They've got a down pat. This is exactly how an RPG should be run.
Mm-hmm.
They do a good mix of like important guides that you need. I think they should do more of them though, like more like players guides, like even if it's just like the guide to gnomes or something like that. Those are super helpful. They should do that, but they don't.
With the new changes, they don't really need those things because they have they hamburgered everyone.
Yeah. Well, what I'm trying to get at is that they should do more for players. That is more like give us a book that says like, okay, here's your guide to the backstory for players on the Sword Coast. So it's a better way of role playing. Essentially, they could give you rules to help you role play better.
Well, yeah, but I mean, who role plays when they play D&D?
It's true. Most people just I murder hobo my way through this town.
No, that's not even that. They're I've taken this build with this combo, so I can use it.
I learned about it from a green text that was reposted to Reddit.
They refer to their characters as builds, not characters. So, I mean, that should tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah, pretty much. You are correct there. Anyway, speaking of Sword Coast, let's get off this Dungeons & Dragons and talk about Dungeons & Dragons, the movie.
Yay! Dungeons and/or Dragons.
Dungeons and or Dragons. That dives. Fuck that joke up. Fuck it.
You fucked up, bro.
So I know you haven't seen it, but I know you also don't care if I spoil 90%.
I don't. I care not for spoilers, and B, I will watch it when it comes to streaming in like, you know, what, 2 years or whatever.
Oh, it would be far sooner than that. It'll probably be 6 months.
Well, I'll probably still watch it in 2 years because like I said, it takes me a really long time to watch anything. Like I just recently watched Kong versus Godzilla, which I enjoyed.
We could talk about that at a different point.
Because I mean, it's just, about... it, there's really not a lot to talk about. Like, it was fine. Like, I think that is the top and the bottom of that film. Like, yeah, it was fine.
My favorite part of that movie is the very beginning where they're like, Godzilla's attacking Jacksonville, Florida.
That was funny.
It's like, they're acting like that'd be a waste. Like,
exactly.
No,
we can only hope.
We wish. Anyway, Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, it just came out last week. I took my daughter to go see it. It is one of the tightest fantasy scripts I've seen in a long fucking time. And by that, I mean, you sit there and you go, oh, well, that's convenient. That's bad for the plane. That's not well written. And then you realize that it's like, no. They set this up in the first act of the movie. There are like everything that you think is a plot hole or convenience was set up earlier in the movie.
Nice.
And the best part about the movie in general is how well it looks and feels like a game of Dungeons and Dragons. I don't think I've ever could have imagined they caught every little nuance of playing Dungeons and Dragons with a good group. So, for example, there is a scene where the characters have to go up against a puzzle on a bridge, right? Mm-hmm. And this character's trying to explain like how to beat the puzzle. Like they couldn't figure it out on. So in my head, the DM brings them to this puzzle. And then the people are like, can't figure out like that the details to the puzzle are written on the side of the bridge, right?
Nice, because the players can't figure it out. So he's got to.
No one rolls
the game going.
No one can pass their damn perception check.
Right. So none of the players can figure it out, and they can't roll their way past.
They can't roll their way past it. And then the one guy's like, "Well, I'll just fly across." And it's like, "Well, how are you going to get everyone else across?" He's like, "I'll carry them." Well, you can't carry that weight. Like, and they literally, that's like the type of conversation they have in the movie.
That's awesome.
Yes, it was. And then so an NPC explains the puzzle to them, and then immediately the one of the players fucking ruins the puzzle immediately.
That's awesome.
Yes. So that's straight out of a D&D game. And then at the very next instant, sorry for the spoilers, guys. If you haven't seen it, if you don't like the spoilers for it, you could probably skip ahead to like 30 minutes or something. So and so, I don't know.
Yeah, most likely.
And then, you know, after they do that, they ruin the puzzle. The guy's like, "Oh, where'd you get that stick? It's a magic wand that can transport you across." And now you're watching the movie, you're going like, "Oh, that's fucking stupid," right? But mm-hmm. then as a D&D player, you're like, "No, that's legit. That would totally happen."
Yeah.
The DM just trying to save these bad players.
Yes, he's trying to keep the game going. Okay, so that's really cool. Like, I mean, coming from that angle is awesome because, like, it's not like a story in the quote-unquote D&D world. It actually is like a movieized version of someone's tabletop campaign. That's kind of cool.
And that's exactly it. So, but it's not very meta where it's like, "Oh my God, you have to blah, blah, blah." I wouldn't even know how to make it more meta, mm-hmm. but it's just meta enough that if you're paying attention, you get it. You right. as a player, you understand what they are doing here.
Right. Well, they couldn't have gone like full meta, because then like the only people who'd be interested are people who actually like play and know the rules of D&D enough to where it's like they're the only people who are going to be entertained, which is like, I mean, fine. You know, I'm sure that film would find an audience, but that's not what they're going for. They want a movie that everyone can enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, some other things that I really like that are kind of like that are they're explaining everyone gets their backstory told, right? So mm-hmm. everyone's explained their backstory. And then there's the one person who's just like, "Yeah, I'm the barbarian. I like to hit things."
Yes.
So that's awesome. Their backstory. And it's like, you could see there's three people at the table who have all written these backstories where they're, you know, they have all of this struggles and blah, blah, blah. And then there's the one person who's like, "I'm a barbarian. I was raised a barbarian. I
yes.
like to barbarian.
I like hitting things with my axe."
I like hitting things with my axe. And it's like,
great.
Oh, that's so perfect. But the beautiful thing is, Steve, you don't realize it till the end when you say like, "Oh, wait, that was like a kind of like a reference to the tabletop." And then you keep on looking back and back and back and you're like, "Shit, this is exactly like it would play out on the tabletop."
Nice. That's great.
Yeah, and plus, if you're a fan of like the D&D books or the D&D lore, quotation marks, there's a lot of those good Easter eggs. Elminster.
Yeah. Yeah, the fat dragon is apparently a canon dragon in
yep,
Forgotten Realms.
The Underdark,
yeah, which is really funny.
Yeah, they go to the Underdark, yeah. And I'll tell you what, Steve. When they said we're going to the Underdark, I was like, "What? What are they going to do? Dark elves? How are they going to do dark elves? This is going to be amazing if they do dark elves the way I think they're going to do dark elves." And then they get raked over the coals on woke Twitter. Like, this would be amazing.
But, so did they do it?
No, they did not show any dark elves.
Oh,
I know. I think like there was a collect, like most gamers or like progressive gamers who played D&D, and they said they're going to the underdark. I think a lot of us went,
I mean, the key is just to make them look like fucking Elder Scrolls Dark Elves, where they're just kind of like grayish blue.
Yeah, I was going to say like a grayish blue skin would probably.
Yeah, I mean, that's slowly been, I think that's been a change that D&D has slowly been making anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you could also make them, because one of the things that they do in the game, in the movie, is it's very diverse. Like, it's it doesn't feel super diverse, but it's a very diverse movie. I mean, I guess it would feel diverse, but, you know, there's all sorts of colors and body sizes and shapes and everything else like that. But
I'm sure there's a lot of hilarious takes about that on Twitter.
There were when the previews started getting coming out for it. But what was I going to say? Oh, so you could just do that with the dark elves and then they just give them like bright blue eyes or whatever color eyes that they have. I think it's
red.
Blue. It's red. Sorry. The red eyes and the white hair. And then it would have been fine. I think.
Oh, that's true, too. If everyone just has red eyes and white hair, that would work.
Yeah. But, it doesn't matter. They didn't show them to begin with. But you also have a Volo cameo. You have Elminster showing up, of course. Spoilers, sorry. So you got all of that, all the fun stuff. They name drop, Baldur's Gate and Waterdeep. Talk about the Sword Coast. It's pretty D&D-ish. So if like you don't play the game and have only played, the video games, or you only read the books, there's a lot there for you.
Mm.
Yeah. And there was a lot of problem solving in the movie. Like there was a lot of like, how do we get through this trap? How do we get through this problem? It's fun. It feels like, okay, this is the tabletop. This is where we're going to discuss what our plans are and how we're going to do it.
That's cool.
Yeah. And it was also what I really liked about it was it wasn't like large scale threat. Like it wasn't like, this is going to destroy all of Faerun, blah, blah, blah. This was more of like, the city is under attack from a larger threat. We have to save just the city. The larger threat is still out there, but we just have to save this. Well, even more than that, there was very low stakes that the party had to accomplish. And the party got their low stakes. And at the end, they had to have a choice of, do we take care of the mid-level threat or do we ignore it because we have what we want? And no, they went after the mid-level threat. And I was like, this is exactly like a fucking tabletop game.
Nice.
Like, what's your party going to do? Are they going to help the city? Or are they going to let the city fall? So they do that.
Nice. That sounds fun.
Yeah. I mean, it felt very much so. And probably the best thing, now saving this for last, is there is a total Mary Sue character who shows up midway through the movie and then disappears. You know what that is?
The pet DM character.
It's either the pet DM character or it's the guy who's a friend of the DM, comes in for three sessions and then leaves.
Yes. Yes.
Like, here's my character. His name is Zenk. He's a level 15 cleric. And, he's blah, blah, blah. He saved this, blah, 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 blah. And so he shows up, plays for three sessions, and then leaves midway through the movie.
That's perfect. That's great.
And you're saying to yourself, it's like, oh, that's dumb. Why would he just show up like that and disappear? And it's like, no, you have to play the game and you'd understand.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Apparently he was supposed to be Dritzt Duerden, which I'm glad he was not that character.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. He was just like this elf paladin, and everyone was like, or was he? No, he was a cleric, not a paladin.
Okay.
And everyone was like fawning all over him, like how great he was. And of course, Chris Pine's character did not like him. And then at the very end, he's like, I love you, Zank. Because he's so good at everything that he does.
That's awesome.
And it very much feels like a game. Mm-hmm. The one complaint that I did have about it is that I did feel like two of the characters, especially the two female characters, the barbarian and the what's her face, the druid, were that I think that their characters were a little underdeveloped in the movie. I think they could have done more with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my I have my explanations on that, but that goes a little bit more deeper than I think that we would go on this podcast. And I think it's a problem with a lot of the female writing in the movie. Like, there was a lot of females, but I don't think they were written very well.
Female humans.
Yeah, female humans. And I also think, like, the villains were very low stakes, so it was not quite as scary as you hoped it would be. The effects were fun. They were not great, but they were fun. The fat dragon fight scene was amazing, I thought. But yeah, that's kind of my review of Dungeons and Dragons the movie. It's a very enthusiastic thumbs up for me. I would give it an A minus, I'll give it an A minus if you're a Dungeons and Dragons player. If you're just if you have nothing, know nothing about Dungeons and Dragons, and just want to see a movie, I'd probably give it a solid B, if not a B minus, because I think that some of the stuff that would really entice the Dungeons and Dragons player might not make any sense whatsoever to you. So,
well, I mean, by all accounts, it is trending to be a smash hit. So there's that. It's already over. It's like almost 90 million, I think. Ooh, and nice. So it's exceeding its projections. Yeah. So that seems good. If you liked it, there'll probably be a sequel, as long as the hey, if these trends continue,
there's the staff that they have in the movie is super broke, and if anybody brought that to the table, I would be so pissed. I'd be like, no, we're not playing with that.
Oh, that's a classic. You mean a magic item, like a magic staff?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a classic DM mistake too. Like accidentally putting the OP item into the game.
Yes, exactly. God, what is the name of it? It was like I want to say push me, pull you, but that's from something different. It's basically a portal staff. But it just like it works just like a portal gun in the game Portal. Right.
Okay.
So you shoot on one end and then shoot on the other end. In the movie, it's used to great effect, but they use it constantly. And I'm like, there's no magical recharge on this thing. And I know that Wizards has made like stat blocks for all the characters from the movie and a lot of, it's the hither thither staff. That's what it's called. Hither thither thither.
Hither thither.
Yes, hither thither staff. It can. The staff has the ability to create two gateways of blue light that connected to each other. Each portal has an oval about 6 feet by 4 feet. Has to be placed on a flat surface large enough to accommodate it. You can't make it more than a mile. The staff could be used to create a pair of link portals up to 4 times a day and regain some of its power each dawn.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean that makes sense because it's classed as a legendary item, which are busted.
Is it?
Yeah, it says its rarity is legendary, which means it's busted. Like legendary which items,
it's busted.
I mean that's what that category is for. Like if a magic item is legendary, like that shit, it's supposed to be busted. So like a legendary power level is like the infinity gauntlet, like that kind of shit.
Yeah,
that's the stuff that like player characters should never attain for keepsies.
For keepsies.
Yeah, essentially, like you get to use that temporarily, or it's something you need to destroy, because like the One Ring is a legendary power level item. So like that's so I guess that's fair for that one. As long as that was not a generic magic item, you know, I'll give him a pass.
Yeah, the only way that I could think using that in a game would be you're going through the Underdark or someplace like that where you are. It's specifically plotted out when you would need to use that staff.
Yeah.
And that you can't just use it and then wait for it to recharge because you have some sort of crawling dread coming after you.
Sure.
Sort of like that.
You know what? Since this is game classy, let's get a hard hitting journalism going on here about D&D. So I just thought of this, because I know there's a druid in this film who uses wild shape a lot.
Oh God. Yeah. If I got to hear the wild shape argument again.
It's not an argument. Well, I mean, I guess it is an argument, but I'm guessing that it's not what you're going to think of. So anyway, so there's a druid that uses wild shape, right? If this druid turns into an owlbear and we banged, is that bestiality?
Ooh, that's a good call. Yes.
You think so? Even though she is still sentient and fully capable of consent?
You can consent to it. It's still bestiality.
Is it?
Yeah. It's an animal in any way, shape, or form that's not human.
I guess, but we'll see. And that's
or I should say, yeah, well, that gets into a whole different level, but we're talking about Dungeons and Dragons here.
Yeah, because I mean, I would argue, because like the intelligence is different. Like, it's, you know, there's got to be, you know, body wise, you're correct.
I'm going to take that back, Steve. I'm going to go back on what I said. It's not bestiality because owlbears are not beasts. They're technically monsters.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
So it's monstrality or
monstrality. Yeah. Monstrality.
Monstrality. It's not bestiality. No, it would be monstiality. How about we call it that? Oh. Instead of beast. Monstiality. Because they're classified differently, and that's part of the argument with wild shape, is that the druid cannot wild shape into an owl bear because it is classified as a monstrous creature as opposed to an actual beast.
I see.
Yeah.
Are they considered? Well, I thought.
Yeah. And druids can only transform into technically beasts, or I think it's not beasts. I think
no, because you can eventually get to where you can turn into a fucking dragon. There's definitely.
I don't think you can in fifth edition. I think you could only transform into beasts and elementals at a high level.
You totally can. Yeah. Different druidic circles. You can upgrade to turn into. There's like. Druids, there's techniques that go beyond basic wild shape, because there's druids that can turn into aberrations, elementals, plants, swarms. There's even druids that can turn into swarms, because I know there's a druid specialization where you turn into swarms.
Yes, but is there one that lets you transform into creatures
and dragons and colossal size?
But just monstrous creatures. That's the question.
Yes, magical beasts. That's okay. That's one of the categories.
Well, no, magical beasts is different than monstrous creatures.
Well, fey beasts as well. So yeah. it looks like you can't. It looks like, so from what it looks like you cannot do, like, if you go into this specialization, you can't do all of them. So like, if you were to be able to turn into, so a fey beast, that means you could turn into an owlbear, but then you could then,
is if you have a fey beast?
I think an owlbear is a fey beast, isn't it?
I don't know. This is why I don't DM fifth.
Well, whatever the case is, if you become that specialized, you can't turn into the other thing. So like, you're not able to turn into an elemental and then also a dragon.
Yes.
Like, you've specialized into one or the other.
Yes. All right. I'm going to pause it here and then we'll come back.
All right. Sorry for the delay of my joining. I had to Google sexy owlbear.
Oh, I thought you were going to Google bear for what you could wild shape into an owlbear, but you did the more Steve thing and looked up sexy owlbears.
Yes. Sexy owlbear.
Sexy owlbears.
I will say this. I'm both disappointed and not by the results.
That's the best way you could ask. That's the thing you could ask for any sort of fan sexiness art.
Yeah. So there we go. I'm disappointed that there is not enough, but also there is some. So
all right. So the next thing I wanted to talk about is something that's a little more near and dear to my heart. So Picard, you've made it through the first four episodes.
I did. I'm actually up to. I'm a little past episode four now. What the fuck am I at? I just got. Spoilers for Picard, I guess. Yeah. I just got to the episode where Ro showed up.
Oh, it's so good. That entire episode, it's very, very well deserved. So I think in the last cast, someone gave me some shit. I'm just one person. I remember reading it, and because I should never read comments on anything, who was talking about how I shit on the guy who played Jar Jar, or I shit on Star Wars. Because even when I'm talking about Star Trek, I got to shit on Star Wars.
Hey, I mean, shitting on Star Wars is a national pastime. We should all do it.
Yes. But I mean, like, it's the example of like, oh, good. Ahmed Best came into the show, The Mandalorian, with his character from a Star Wars trivia show that was on YouTube, and everyone's like, oh, yay. But then you have on Star Trek Picard, you have Ro Laren, who is arguably one of the biggest betrayals in Star Trek history, right?
Easily.
I mean, you understand why she does what she does, but she betrays Starfleet and Picard, who gave her a chance and was willing to work with her.
Yeah, she basically, like, very specifically backstabs Picard.
Yes. And then you have that, she comes back and they address it head on, and it was absolutely amazing.
It was very well written, very well done.
Yeah, the entire first four episodes, I will maintain, should be recut into a next gen movie.
Oh yeah, easily. Like that movie was that easily is a movie, and it's a good one too.
And I will say that the next four, so up to episode 8, which I just watched this week, is another great self-contained movie. It's a very much a sequel to the previous one.
So basically we're getting three Star Trek movies, essentially, happening now.
I'm kind of hoping, because of the way it's plotted out, is very much like old school TV writing, man. You have the mini arc within a larger arc, and then you have individual stories in the mini arcs.
Yeah, I mean, I've been so impressed so far. It's taken a fucking while. They took their sweet fucking time, but it seems that they might have, like, going by this and off of Strange New Worlds, it seems, I don't want to speak too soon, but it seems like they found their feet again for Star Trek.
Yeah, as I say, it's like, what's really interesting is Strange New Worlds is technically kind of a prequel to the original series, right?
Yeah.
But it's a prequel, and how do I enrich what's already there for the original series? Like, how do I make the backstories a little bit cooler so that when you see them in the original series, it's better? It doesn't spoil it, but it's better.
Yeah, it's enhancement. It's chocolate sauce on your sundae.
Yeah, it is very much it's a mwah cherry on top.
Yeah.
And then you have Picard, which is kind of the opposite because it's a sequel to the original series and to the Next Generation. But it doesn't enhance it. It just it's very much like, it's not nostalgia. It's very member berries, but it's not like reveling in the nostalgia. It's just making just revisiting these old characters and seeing how they've grown.
Right. Well, I also think that it's very good because it doesn't do member berries like.
Oh, it does tons of member berries.
Well, hang on. It doesn't do member berries in like the shitty Star Wars new movies way. It does it in like a more like, if you don't know what this is, it doesn't matter. If you do know what this is, that was a clever reference, because they usually do things like a one word reference, like someone's like, oh well, we encountered this weird thing one time, and someone's like, yeah, it's Farpoint. He's like, yeah, that's right, like that.
Yeah,
like if you don't know what that is, you're like, oh, okay, so they're referencing on a previous adventure they had. If you do, you're like, oh yeah, nice. But like in like Star Wars and in a lot of other member berries bait content, they like look directly at the camera, get real close, and wink at you. I don't think it's doing that.
I there are a couple of them, but it's not bad. It's not terrible. There are, but what that is that's just what does Spock say in Star Trek VI? Sauce for the goose, Mr. Chekhov. That's sauce what it is. Goose. I believe that's the what he says. Sauce for the goose, Mr. Chekhov. I just watched Star Trek V last night. Oh my god, that movie is so much worse than I remember it being. I still love it.
Sauce for the goose, Mr. Savick.
Mr. Savick. There you go. Sorry.
Yes, Mr. Savick. Because that's from Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, no, that's from Six, I believe. No, it is from Wrath of Khan. You are correct. But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, it's just I watched Star Trek V with a bunch of people who are not Star Trek fans. Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, this movie is fucking slow as shit.
How is it on the scale of Star Trek, the motion picture?
Star Trek, the motion picture was very beautiful to look at. Star Trek V is not very beautiful to look at.
Got it. That's the Final Frontier, right? That's like widely considered the worst.
That's the worst of the original six.
Right.
Because I don't include Generations with that, because there was no Spock. Without Spock, it is not a Star Trek movie. Or an original series movie.
Yes. No, that's fair.
Yeah. What was I going to say on that one? Oh, yeah. So, yeah, five is just bad. It's still, like, the effects are, like, noticeably horrendous. Because I just watched one through four recently, and the effects in five are so fucking bad. Which is weird because it's done by the same guy who did like Tron and what else did he do at the Silent Running? Douglas Trumbull, who just died last year. but he did all the effects on it. I'm like, did he actually do these effects or did he pass it off to some like intern? That's what it seems like. Anywho, getting back to the, yes, there are plenty of,
Uhura does something super sexy and like a weird outfit in that movie.
She does the fan dance
right,
to distract the people, which is not great.
Right.
What was I going to say? Yes. So the member berries, there are plenty of them, like plenty of callbacks to old stuff that's happened. And a lot of that is like, oh, so like when they go on, you haven't gotten that episode yet, I don't think. So I'm not going to go into that too much.
Oh, and also I love Shaw. Shaw's awesome.
Oh, and Shaw is just an amazing new character. Actually, most of the new characters they introduce are pretty fun.
I will agree.
In this sense. But Shaw is great. I don't love Shaw. I didn't love Shaw at first. I appreciated him and I thought he was funny, but I didn't like him because I didn't feel he was very Star Trek-y. And then they do. Have you gotten to his backstory yet about Wolf?
Yes. 359? Okay. Yes.
I don't remember when that happened. And I think it was episode 4. But they,
it was like, yeah, it was either 4 or 5. But yeah, no, they cover it.
So I went back and I watched all of episodes 1 through 8. Just because I felt like that was a good point. It was like after the second story arc had ended, I was like, I really want to watch all of this to see if what it's built up to. Mm-hmm. And all the stuff that makes Shaw seem like an asshole is because of his trauma, right?
Yes. Like literally everything. Like
you
every single thing.
You would excuse it if it's like, when you learn his backstory, you're like, oh, well, this is why he's an asshole. It's like, no, you got to look at the way he specifically is an asshole.
Yes.
And then
what
you
he
understand
is specifically
it.
Doing like, yeah. Like what, like he doesn't call 7-7, like that yeah. kind of shit. Like, it's
well,
like,
it's that, but it's also like everything he says is like, no, I have to protect this crew.
Also true.
Like it's like, I am not risking the ship. I am going against a superior enemy and risking the crew to save these people. Right. But every time he has to, like, it's brought up, like, you can't leave these people to die alone out here. Like these are, you know, important. These are, you know, heroes and everything. And you're letting them die out here. And as soon as she says not letting them die out there, that's when he goes and rescues them.
Yes.
Like he doesn't, like, he knows he doesn't want to do it, but he can't leave anybody behind.
Yes.
Which is amazing because of his backstory.
Yeah, it's very good. Very, very well written. Very, very well written character. Very cool. I was really enjoyable.
But I absolutely love like his shit when he's like, no, I'm going to give them Jack Crusher. And then he's like, he's my son. He's like, well, fuck.
Yes. Yeah, that's great.
He doesn't actually say that.
Yeah.
But
he's
it's like
he immediately changes and is like, all right, battle stations.
Yeah. It's like, because and the other thing that's pretty great about it is he is a D&D player himself. The guy who plays Shaw.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
He's a big D&D player, and he was actually at GaryCon running events literally last weekend.
Nice.
Or 2 weekends ago, whenever GaryCon
was. That's awesome.
I think it's the same weekend as what's it called? As Adepticon. So
awesome.
yeah, he was there doing his thing. He's got his own website with his own D&D gear. I did not know anything about this, but I was looking him up to see if he was going to do any appearances. I found this whole like down the rabbit hole of his D&D stuff. He's like written shit for RPGs. I don't know what game in particular, but
that's
he's
awesome.
A big D&D-er.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny because I also really like that fucking Honey Bunny is the villain.
Amanda Plummer, who's, you know, who her father was.
Amanda Plummer's father or the character's father?
Well, Amanda Plummer's father and his character.
I don't remember who Amanda Plummer's father is.
He played, I believe it was Commander Chang from Star Trek VI.
Really? Oh, that's dope.
Yeah. So I mean, she has a little bit of a pedigree with Star Wars because her dad literally was the bad guy in Star Trek VI.
Oh, that's so cool!
Yeah, Chang. I think it was a general or it was something.
Commander. Probably or general. No, he was a Klingon, so it's probably general.
Yeah, he was. he's the Shakespeare one, the Shakespeare general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, You haven't read Shakespeare until you read it in its original Klingon. But yeah, he was. So that's, it's pretty great that he was in Star Trek VI and now she's the bad guy of Picard season three. And she does really well at it. She, you know, she's a classic villain. She chews the scenery. Her backstory, I do not think is as interesting, but I do like that Picard season three, while being a Star Trek The Next Generation sequel, is also a sequel to DS9 and Voyager.
This is that so far. Yes, there's been a lot of content from basically all the 90s Trek.
Yeah, which is pretty impressive. And when you get, I think it's in episode 7, which you might not, you're probably not into. No, you're not, because if you just got to row, I think that was 5 or 6. But episode 7, there is some Enterprise references for you.
Ooh,
so not to spoil it that much.
I do like me some Enterprise.
Episode, maybe it was episode 6. I think it was episode 6. Episode 6. But episode 6 is also probably one of the most member berry heavy episodes. And not in a it's in a way that, as a Star Trek fan, that's what I want. Like, these are the type of member berries that I want to eat.
Right. Okay. They're not bitter member berries.
They're not bitter member berries. They're not like Star Wars where it's like, remember the guy that played Jar Jar? Here he is. And it's and it's like he does this thing that we have no motivation of him doing or why he would do it.
Somehow,
or anything like that.
Palpatine has returned.
Somehow Palpatine has returned. But it's more of it's more member berries of like, you know, you two assholes crashed the saucer section, you know, things like
I did that where I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes, when Shaw's like they're like, oh yeah, well, we have saved the galaxy, and he's like, oh yeah, you have saved the galaxy, but you also did this and
you
this.
you broke the prime directive, you crashed the saucer section.
Yeah,
so no, well, sir, fuck you, good day.
And specific call out too. He's like, you broke the directive because you wanted to bang some lady on Baku. Which was awesome. I was like, that's great. I was like, he legit that was like a fan call out. It was great.
Yeah, it was a fan call out to like the worst movie at Star Trek. But
You think it's worse than 5? There's no way it's worse than 5.
Oh, absolutely. Generations is worse than 5. Not Generations, Insurrection is worse than 5. Dude, Steve, Picard is swinging around like Tarzan in that movie.
I can't agree. You know what? I can't agree. I cannot. I mean, I'm not gonna take up and say Insurrection is anything amazing, but like worse than 5.
Yes,
it's pretty bad, man.
5 has, 5 is saved by one thing only. Excuse me. I have a question. Why does God need a starship?
Five's got to be worse than Insurrection. I mean at this point, I mean, we're comparing, like, you know, two rotten meals, so it's like, which rotten meal would you rather eat? At the end of the day, you're still eating a rotten meal.
Yeah, so the and it's also, what's funny is that I believe Star Trek V had a bigger budget than Insurrection, and it does not look like
that's
it had a
crazy
budget. Yeah. And it was 89 money. So like Insurrection, I think came out in like what, 98, 99?
98, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, somewhere around. No, it might have been 97. No, because whatever. Doesn't matter. But yeah, it came out.
Because First Contact, I'm pretty sure, was 96. So yes. Then, so it should be
97
general
or 98. Timelines.
Yeah, 97.
At least 98. At minimum 98.
Yeah, yeah.
Movies weren't cranked out as fast back then.
Yeah.
So yeah, it just is like, what? Why does this movie look so bad? And I think it's just because it all went to the actors at that point, just to get them in.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, because I think they did Wrath of Khan on like a $12 million budget.
Ah, that movie's so fucking good.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, but yes.
Well, there's that, like, I mean, I don't know if it's an actual like theory, but something that I've always thought about, like, there's a budget sweet spot. I mean, I'm sure this is probably something that, like, everyone's like, oh, everyone knows this, but I don't know. But like, for me, there's always a budget sweet spot where, like, it's very easy to have too little or too much money for your film. And if you have either, your movie's going to end up bad.
Yep. You're absolutely correct. That is a well-known thing.
Yeah. It's like, you need to have the exact right amount where, like, you know, the writing needs to be tight enough so that it doesn't get over bloated. You know, you have to have believable effects to convey the story. There is a sweet spot for your film, and it's just, and it's, but I think it's very easy to go to the too much or too little money.
Yeah, well, that's here's what I say. I say you have your what you're saying, the sweet spot for the budget. But then what you also have to have is a studio exec giving you $5 million or not 5% less of your budget than what that sweet spot is. And here's the reason why, Steve, because 5% is just enough that you have to be a good filmmaker to compensate.
Yeah, what did we say? It was like an average of 20 minutes of every movie can be cut.
Yeah.
You might actually have to cut that 20 minutes because you don't have enough money.
Exactly. And it causes you to be, it makes you a better filmmaker. But anyway, so that's our review for the first four episodes of Picard are very, very positive.
Yes, absolutely. Watch it. It's fucking great. Even if you hated season one and two, you should watch three because it's three's fucking incredibly good.
Yeah. And I don't,
also don't need to watch season one or two.
So I watched season one and it was bad. I never watched season two. And I heard season two was even more, or I shouldn't say more, but it was as dumb as season one.
Season two is weird. Season two has, so I would say season two has better peaks and roughly the same valleys as season one.
Yeah.
That would be my review of season two.
Well, spoilers. We're not already spoiling it enough, but Picard's body gets replaced with a robot.
Oh yeah,
that's
the climax of season one, and that is the dumbest thing.
Yeah,
it's just like, why did you like that? The worst part about that is like it was so meaningless.
Yes.
Like it was so like that's the point. Like that should be something that, like, if you're going to do this, like this thing that's supposed to be like this huge thing, it changes the character literally zero. Cause they're like, yeah, it's a robot golem body. Will this mean I have super strength? No, it's the same exact strength you used to have. Oh, well, will this mean I'll live forever? No, it copied you perfectly. So you're going to live the exact amount of time. It's like, oh, okay. So what's the difference between my body now? Oh, we can reference that you have a positronic body. Oh
yeah. So
that's
it's
the difference.
Like,
yeah, that's the difference. Oh, I see.
Yeah, the whole thing with the positronic body, I think that's the only thing that if you didn't know about it, it would be confusing for the season three.
Yes, yeah, they reference positronic a few times.
Yeah, well, and you'll find out why in a couple episodes that it's important, but that's what I would say is the only thing from the earlier seasons that if they are referenced, and that's the only important thing to know.
Well, if they make that have a pay, all I'm going to say is if they successfully make that have a payout in this season, I will actually be very happy about that, because I thought it was extremely stupid at the end of season one, because like it's like this like big thing. It's like, yeah, no, it's completely meaningless. So if it actually ends up having meaning in this season, I would be pleased as punch about that.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily paying off. I think they're trying to retroactively make it pay off, which is not great. But it's, if it's done in a way that's good enough, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
As I say, good enough at this point for Star Trek is enough for me.
I agree with that.
Yeah. But the what was I going to say? One of the showrunners for season three is trying to get a new Trek show made out of the Titan. And I think they were calling it Star Trek Legacy. So
with Shaw? I would watch the fuck out of
it. See, I don't know. I like Shaw as a side character. I don't know if I'd like him as the captain.
Make him a side character in his show. Like literally use him how much he's being used now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's the way to do it. Like, if they... So the whole thing is they want to focus on, like, Geordi LaForge's daughter. Like, so if she was the main character, I could see that. It would work out. But I don't know. Shaw is one of those characters who's used just enough in those first four episodes that I wish they used him as much in the next four episodes. They still use him, but not as much in the first four episodes. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't get a chance to shine as much.
Yeah, no, I think that would be really cool. Yeah, you have him in there and you don't make him the, like, you don't make him the captain as in like how, you know, Kirk or Picard was the captain, but you put him in there.
Yeah, I would say that you probably use him like the captain, like they do in Discovery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
captain's not the main character.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, yeah, I would definitely like to see that.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get to some listener questions before I forget and we run out of time.
Let's go.
All right. So Raza, of course, has finally joined us on the Discord after being a longtime user on the Facebook page.
Yes. Oh, and yeah, don't forget to purchase some dope figures from Warpath going native. Raz's son is sick, and any additional funds will help him out. So
yeah, there you go.
Buy some cool models and do a good thing at the same time.
So he asked, you guys keep talking about alternating activations on your cast. Could you name a game that uses alternating activations or could explain how it works in a war game on your next cast, please?
Yes. So there's a lot of games that use alternating activations.
Almost every game except historicals, most historicals, and Games
and
Workshop games.
And block games. Block games don't use alternating.
Yeah.
I take that back. I immediately have to correct myself because Conquest is a block game and that uses alternate activations. Yeah.
So the simple explanation on alternating activation is that as Games Workshop, you do everything on your side all at once. And then your opponent does everything on their side all at once. Then next turn, that's the normal activation system of Games Workshop. I don't know what
resolution is also linear time.
Yes. So that's I go, you go, right? That would be the way to describe that.
Yes, I go, you go.
And then alternating activations, simply put, is that each phase of that I go, you go turn. So let's say shooting, I would do all the shooting, and then Steve would do all the shooting.
Yes,
then
again, with the damage being resolved in linear time. So if Joe blows up half my army can't shoot.
Yes. But there's also alternating activation where you could do I do one unit who does everything for them, and then Steve does one unit and everything for them, and then I go on to my next unit, and then once all units have been completed, the turn would end and we'd re-rack.
Yes.
So that's the two types of alternating activation I can think of. It's like phase-based or like unit-based alternating activation.
Where like I activate this unit, it does everything. So it does its movements, it does its shooting, it does its melee, and then that unit's done, then we go to the next unit.
And then there's some games with the variable alternating activation, which is like bolt action. Bolt action, you pull the die from a cup, and whoever pulls the die gets to move one unit of theirs and complete all of their activations at one time. So I could hypothetically move, my entire army before Steve's dice gets pulled, but that's all just luck of the pull. Or if you kind of know what you're doing and you could peek ahead of time and cheat it. It's a variable alternating activation. Most smaller games use an alternating activation system. Almost every GW game that's non-Warhammer 40K, Horus Heresy, or Age of Sigmar, even Age of Sigmar's borderline alternating activation, but
it has like it has a lot of stuff you can do on your opponent's turn, so it's like it's got like interrupts, which is another that's another way you can do it if you don't want to do alternating activation, giving a player, because I guess that, now that I think about it, classic Warhammer was not alternating activation obviously, but you were not completely helpless on your opponent's turns because you had charge reactions. You could stand and shoot, you could flee.
Most games that have the I go you go system have some form of interrupt, and any historical I can think of has always had like brace for charge or Overwatch or whatever,
right?
And even now Games Workshop still has those built into their systems. They're built off war games that were written by Rick Priestley in 1988, or even 78, let's go that early. But yeah, those are the mostly what alternating activation means. I think I kind of like the I'm going to do my whole unit's movement, shooting, whatever, and then as opposed to phase wise, because I think it's just, to me, that's a little more fun. And I think that's a little more strategic. I enjoy that. I still think bolt action's alternating activation system, variable alternating activation system, is probably one of the most fun mechanics I've played with in the last 10 years.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of I like Conquests a lot. I do prefer there's a couple systems I like, but I do like alternating activation where everything does its whole thing, where like the unit does its whole thing, whatever it's gonna do, it you spend the unit. I like that. I'm a fan of that style. But I do think if you want to go middle is also really good too, where you like Or you can actually do all. I just take it back. I think if you wanted to do like an optimal one, you would do alternating activations for every phase. So the same. So like just basically like you think you're playing Warhammer. We do our movement phase. So we alternate our activations back and forth, and do everything's movement. Then we do the shooting phase. We alternate our activations back and forth for shooting. Then we alternate our activations back and forth for melee.
So what you're saying is some sort of like mega alternating activation.
Yeah, like a super system where like
super everything. I like the idea of the super system
where everything alternates.
All right. Okay.
Because that way you don't need to you don't need to worry about like the because that will also organically take care of the snowballing effect. Because even if I shoot my unit in the shooting phase and you have your unit can't do anything about that, like being shot at, the very next thing that's going to happen is one of your units is going to get the chance to fire.
Oh. How about I got an idea for an alternating activation, a variable alternating activation system, right? Basically, it's two card decks. Like, let's say you have your red cards. I have my black cards.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say I have 12 units or 10 units and you have 8 units. So you'd have 1 through 8 in your deck and I would have 1 through 10 in my deck. So I would, and you have to sort your cards into the way you want it to be pulled. And then when you, at the start of an activation, you each flip a card and whoever has the highest card gets to activate their unit first.
Okay.
And then your opponent would then get to go do theirs. So, but you can shuffle your deck in such a way that you know certain cards are going to be pulled first.
Mm, I see.
So, you know, like, oh shit, well, this guy really wants to go first. So he's going to probably put his 10 card. I can't beat a 10 card because I only have 8. So I'm going to put my 1 card there because I know it's just going to be a blown card anyway.
Sure. Yeah, no, that could work. There's tons of different ways to make the alternating system work. And
TM game classy. I'm just
yes. There. Oh yeah, all of our ideas are TM. There's tons of ways to make alternating system works. And like, yes, the first thing is like, yes, if someone has more units, they have an advantage. So figure out how to balance that. Like there's tons of different ways to balance that too. Like the way it works in BattleTech. If you have more than double, you have to move your models until you have double. So like if you have 4 and I have 1, you move until you have 1, then I move mine, then you move yours.
Mm-hmm.
So you basically have to do more of your stuff first, if you have more, and then shooting phase is shared and not done in linear time. So like I do my shooting, you do your shooting, then we apply the damage, the damage effects.
Damage. All right. Let's move on to another question. Let's see. Do-do-do-do. All right. Is there a shittier range of models other than a shittier range of modern miniatures than Warlords? Also, what happened to the board game industry? It is as sad as it is today. We now get thousands of releases per year with very few standouts. Modern miniatures range than Warlord. Yes, but you don't really see them because they're like sculpted by some guy named Giuseppe in his basement.
Well, yeah, and but then those aren't. That's not. I wouldn't consider that a modern miniatures range. Then,
yes. Well, I think he means modern mini range of. Oh, okay. Modern miniatures is in probably the last 20 years. Let's say.
Yeah.
But no, there's not. I think Warlord sculpts are awful. Their plastics are awful, and it just. I would never play with a Warlord miniature ever if I had the option. So just keep that in mind, that Warlord's miniatures are that bad. And which is funny because their Napoleonics, their Romans, they're all good sculpts. Those are nice sculpts. Most of their stuff is nice.
Yeah, see, their Romans look pretty good.
Yeah, but their World War II stuff is fucking terrible. And a lot of their old metals for all the ranges are just god awful.
Yeah, because I know their plastic Roman legionnaires are solid. But yeah, when you mentioned that in the last cast, I actually looked at a lot of their bolt action stuff, and holy shit.
Yeah, it's bad. And the board game industry, Steve, what's your opinion on that one?
I mean, if you want like the correct and very brief answer, the answer is line go up. That's why. They everyone is trying to release as many games as possible so they can get so they can do the next Wingspan. They're all looking for the next giant hit, and they've decided that the way to find it is by releasing as many games as you possibly can until the board game community gloms onto one.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so like that's really what it is. Like they're taking the shotgun approach to try and get the next wingspan. Because the thing is, like, a lot of these games are all good. Like, they're not bad. Like, they're not bad board games. The problem is like, the only thing board game players want are S tier board games, and they release a lot of B and A tier board games. That's what it is. Like, that's really the end all be all. Also, Kickstarter is a huge contributor to the board game flood, because there's so many board games that have come out on Kickstarter, like so many that are successful on Kickstarter, whether or not the game is good. So then you have, you know, just tons and tons of games coming out. And then there's a lot of like sameziness. And then also you have to remember the biggest board game manufacturer, the two biggest board game manufacturers in the world are both, you know, publicly stock traded companies. So, you know, saying, hey, we want to take our time to release an excellent board game. Them going, no, you need to have 3 releases for quarter 1, 3 releases for quarter 2, 4 releases for quarter 3, and 5 releases for quarter 4. And they all need to make this much money or you're all fired. Like, yeah. That is why.
Yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with, aside from the line go up aspect of it, I think a lot of it has to do with certain games get successful, and then other companies who want to make line go up try to copy what made that game successful. So a lot of them will jam-pack their game full of miniatures, yes, without caring too much for the rules or presentation or anything like that.
Yep, that's why you see all of these games that look the fucking same or are literally the, like, how many, like, remember we were talking, like, you and I were like waxing about the horror movie board game.
Yeah,
have you seen how many fucking horror movie board games there are now? There's like a shit ton of them. It's like an epidemic.
It's an epidemic. And I think another thing is that they aren't being very creative with rules. So I think the number one thing that people have to realize with a game, any game, is that a game has to be fun. And if a game's not fun, then why even bother playing it? So, I mean, and that could go back to the 40K argument, because when was the last time a 40K game was fun?
Yeah, I don't know, bro.
That's what I say to that. I don't know if that picked it up on the microphone.
I didn't hear it, but I assume you farted.
Yes, I did.
Okay, very good.
But yes, that, so the board game market, it's just people want to make money, so they copy off of whatever made the last successful game successful, and they don't care about being original. They don't care about being fun. They just give you more of what they think you wanted with that game. But really what makes a game successful is word of mouth and playability, and if it's fun. Because if a game is fun, people will tell other people to play the game. That's what it comes down to. And other people will buy that game.
It's true.
But anyway, one thing I did want to mention on that as well is that, who was it? Damas commented that Warlord did Dreadball. So yes. And I wanted to point out that I may be wrong on this, but Warlord did not do Dreadball. Dreadball was done by Mantic Games.
Yes, that is correct. Dreadball, I don't know if... Dreadball is Mantic.
I don't know if Warlord took over from Mantic or anything else like that, if there's like some hidden history of Dreadball, but I believe Dreadball was just done by Mantic.
Yes. Yeah, they had to be. Unless... No, it was Mantic. Dreadball's for sure Mantic, for sure.
Yeah. All right, then. That takes us to the end.
Although, speaking of bad minis, I will say Mantic has, like, night and day'd their sculpting quality, in my opinion. I think their newer stuff is quite nice.
Mm, yeah, it's fine. I'm not writing home about it. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, but I mean,
Mantic's best thing that they have done lately is their terrain. Their terrain is fantastic.
Oh, their terrain's fucking great.
Slightly overpriced, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, their terrain's really good.
It's a little overpriced for what it is. I mean, I understand that you're getting a bunch of sprues to make a bunch of stuff, but I don't want to pay slightly less than GW for just about the same amount of plastic that I have to cut and put together all by myself.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, I know we talked about it on the last cast, but like, I really think that Battlefield in a Box is the optimal home
really
play
is.
Solution. Like,
it's cheaper. It's put together nicely. It's painted nicely.
Yeah, there's
no major issue with it, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's Battlefield in the Box. I guess like the one quote unquote issue I would have with it is that there's not a huge range of product.
Well, it's also, it goes down to the common joke of like, amazing looking table, bro. Can't play shit on it. But
yeah, you don't want that.
And tabletop terrain is like, if you just buy one set and you put it out there, Battlefield in a Box, and you put it out there, it looks good and you could play on it. Like, all yeah. you need is like probably $200-$300 worth of the stuff to make one set. And that's, and there you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's very playable. All right. So we're running out of time. So we got to end here. Go to the Game Classy Facebook page. It's the best way to find the link to the Game Classy Discord, where we actually reside in our tiny hole underneath our bridge. The best way you can help out the podcast is like, comment, subscribe on the iTunes, or like, comment, subscribe on the YouTube. I believe both of those options are available and can be commented on. If you'd like to follow me more, you could follow me on, or you could get in contact with me, actually, is a good place, is on Instagram. I'm at Game Classy Joe. Steve is currently offline because he's threatened Jeff Bezos one too many times.
It wasn't Jeff Bezos, but yes.
Yeah, or Elon Musk.
Elon was one of them.
Yes, I'm well aware. So Steve is currently in hiding until it until the fuzz is
until the heat dies down. The heat's got to die down.
All right. So Steve, until next time.
Watch Picard season 3. Really.
Woohoo!
Later.
Game Classy.